Okay, we are off to an excellent start, as Dick said. Let us now move on to the first session, the War on Terrorism, a year on. The broad purpose of this session is to take stock of where we are in the War on Terrorism, more specifically to ask what have we accomplished over the last year, or the first phase, as General Scowcroft called it. What are the challenges that lie ahead in the second phase, hopefully the last phase? Are we winning this war on terrorism? And if that's not the correct term, are we at least on the right trajectory? And if not, what should we be doing differently, both at home and abroad, to get us on the right track? General Scowcroft has already given us his thoughts on some of these questions. They're very provocative, and I hope the panel we have here today will join those observations from General Scowcroft. We have an excellent panel of speakers, whom I will briefly introduce now. We will start with Dr. Paul Piller, National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia at the National Intelligence Council and former Deputy Chief of the CIA's Counter-Terrorist Center. He is the author of a Brookings book, Terrorism and American Foreign Policy, which I believe came out right before 9/11. Great timing. He will be followed by Brian Jenkins, just to prove this panel is not a conspiracy of men named Paul. Brian is no stranger to many of you in being one of the world's leading authorities on international terrorism and organized crime. In addition to chairing the Institute's International Research Group on Political Violence, he is currently a senior advisor to the president of RAND and has just completed a new study for them on how to counter Al-Qaeda. And we have a copy here right off the press. And I've been told by Brian that 150 copies will be made available outside the room later this morning. He claims also that he's not getting any royalties for this. Finally, we will hear from Ambassador Paul Bremer, the former chair of the National Commission on Terrorism and U.S. Ambassador at Large for Counterterrorism. He is now Managing Director and Senior Advisor for Political and Emerging Risks at Marsh McLennan Companies. I've asked each to speak for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we can open up the floor for questions and answers. Paul, you have the floor.
Thank you, Paul, and good morning. It's a real privilege for me to participate in this conference along with my distinguished co-panelists and to follow at this podium General Scowcroft, who sounded many of the themes that I hope to sound, but one or two or three of them I'm going to elaborate on in just a slightly different direction. I want to start with a few general observations about what I think we have accomplished over the past year and what has come to be known as the War on Terrorism, what is realistic to expect in the months and years ahead, and then close with two or three points about what I think is most important to remember in trying to achieve further objectives in the months ahead. The starting point for considering what has been accomplished since last September is to ask ourselves, what really changed last September, changed suddenly? And it wasn't the threat, because the threat was out there. And people who had been monitoring it were fully aware of the nature of it in a strategic sense, although, as always, we lacked the tactical information. What changed was our reaction to the threat. A sudden and dramatic increase in the priority that the American people and their government give to counterterrorism. And largely because of this, an increase in the priority that other governments have been giving to the topic over the past year. That priority, the sheer degree of commitment to combating terrorism, both at home and abroad, makes a big difference. I would suggest to you that it is at least as important as the specific questions about the effectiveness of this or that counterterrorist technique or how we organize our government to go after the problem. I'm not belittling these issues. I'm just saying the net effect on how well we do in this effort rests, first of all, on the depth of commitment of the American public and how that commitment gets expressed in Congress and elsewhere in our government. It matters, of course, as far as resources are concerned, and the willingness of the American people to sustain an effort through paying taxes, as that gets translated into number of FBI agents who do the surveillance that they're charged with doing, number of sky marshals, number of intelligence officers who sort through that mountain of information and everything else. It also matters with regard to the willingness of us, the American public, to bear the security burdens we bear every day going through metal detectors and taking circuitous routes for security purposes and so on. But the degree of commitment matters in a number of other respects, which get into the offensive side of counterterrorism, and that's the main thing I wanted to focus on. Consider Operation Enduring Freedom, the military effort in Afghanistan that our military has waged in conjunction with a number of our allies since last fall. It has accomplished a lot. The regime that prior to last fall had been more closely in bed with terrorists and terrorist operations than any other, namely the Taliban, has been ousted. The headquarters element, if we can call it that, of the group with which we are most concerned, Al-Qaeda, has been rousted from the home it has had or had had for the previous 5 years. A good number of terrorist operatives, including some fairly senior types, have been captured or killed. A very strong message has been sent of the price to be paid by regimes as well as groups for getting involved in terrorism. And a process at least has begun of political reconstruction in Afghanistan that offers the hope of lifting that country out of the terrorist-infested abyss in which it has dwelled for the past several years. Whether that process will continue successfully is the very important topic of the next panel, and I, for one, will stick around and listen closely. Now, we knew even before last September the basic parameters of what was going on in Afghanistan, the nature of Al-Qaeda, the deadly threat it posed to the United States, the nature of the very close relationship between bin Laden and his gang and Mullah Omar and the Taliban leadership. So one might ask, might it have made sense to do something like Operation Enduring Freedom before rather than after a tragedy like September 11? I think the answer is, well, we could have gotten many of the same benefits with an earlier operation, but of course, if that type of operation had been attempted as a preemptive act rather than a response to the outrage that was September 11th, it would have been far, far more difficult to justify to the American public, let alone to foreign publics and governments. But coming as it did after that outrage, as General Scowcroft noted in the last hour, there was virtually no opposition to mounting this military operation in this land half a globe away, about which Americans otherwise would care little or nothing. Because we have the increased degree of commitment, we as a nation and our military were able to achieve what they've achieved during the past year in Afghanistan. Something similar has occurred with regard to financial interdiction and going after the terrorist money. There has been a big, big difference in the results that have been achieved in the seizing and freezing of terrorist assets since last September. Sure, there are limitations, and some of these were most recently publicized by the UN Sanctions Committee report that you read about in the papers over the last week, and we still have most of the same old handicaps in trying to go after the money, use of false names by terrorists, use of hawala or informal money transfer networks outside the banking systems. Those are all still challenges for us. But the difference in the amount of funds seized or freezed before and after last September, as far as groups and individuals as opposed to states are concerned, has been stark. We've gone from the low six figures to the nine figures in terms of the amount of money involved. And this wasn't because the intelligence suddenly got better. It was because the degree of commitment by the American public and the American government to do something about this increased dramatically last fall. And that means not only our government does more on this, but our diplomats and our U.S. Treasury officials, when they talk to foreign officials, can pound on the table and say, the United States is deadly serious about this. We insist on your cooperation. And don't give me that stuff about, well, you know, you have to give us more specific information and maybe we can do something about it, which has so often been the usual response. Similarly, with other forms of disruption of terrorist networks that go beyond the money, arresting people, deporting people, raiding apartments, seizing materials, all these things that foreign officials and services have to do, the fact that we have a stronger degree of U.S. commitment and our officials can go out and pound on some foreign tables has made a big difference. So what should the bottom line of our scorecard be with regard to what's been accomplished and where we stand in this effort a year later? Well, my bottom line would be, much has been accomplished, significant dangers remain. And there's nothing inconsistent about those two statements. Even if you look just at the organization that we know of as Al-Qaeda, and bearing in mind the substantial costs that have been inflicted on it and hindrances put in its path, both by the military efforts in Afghanistan and by the other less public counterterrorist efforts worldwide, it is still, without question, a significant threat capable of inflicting substantial harm on U.S. interests abroad and at home. And it's not just what we know of as Al-Qaeda, which is not to be equated even with the radical Sunni Islamist part of the terrorist picture, let alone the larger constellation of terrorists and terrorist groups that could pose a threat to U.S. interests. I am optimistic that we will achieve something that can be called a victory over Al-Qaeda, perhaps in something like the next couple of years, although I, like General Scowcroft, am extremely hesitant to put time frames on these things. Whether it would be wise to declare such a victory is a separate issue. But that, of course, would not be an end to a war on terrorism overall, which would continue to be waged. We would have to continue to wage it against, among others, perhaps fragments of or successors to Al-Qaeda or other groups driven by the sorts of inner demons that drive bin Laden and his gang. We Americans like to have our wars fought against clear, definite enemies and to have clear, definite ends. Al-Qaeda has served as our enemy over the past year, and with good reason, because it does constitute the leading threat to U.S. interests through terrorism. But for the reasons I just mentioned, it would be a mistake to think of it as the only enemy. And as far as ends are concerned, as Secretary Rumsfeld had observed earlier and as General Scowcroft reminded us in the past hour, we can't expect a surrender on the deck of the Missouri. We need in this war to think in terms of sustained efforts of indefinite duration. It would certainly not be realistic to expect an end of terrorism. It is realistic to expect enhanced counterterrorist efforts with a foreign policy that is supportive of them to significantly weaken the anti-U.S. terrorist threat, to reduce the likelihood of deadly harm being done to Americans, and to alleviate the climate of fear that has been so much an attribute of our national life over this past year. Now, of the many things it's important to remember in trying to pursue that realistic sort of objective, I would, in closing, emphasize the following three, and General Scowcroft has already touched on a couple of these. One, we have to use all of the counterterrorist instruments available to us and to use them in tandem. It is not just a military problem. It is not just a law enforcement problem. It is not just an intelligence problem. It is not something we can tackle just by going after the money or just by sending our diplomats out. We have to use all of those tools in concert together with proper attention to policies which affect the roots and causes of some of the terrorism that we face, including policies having to do with emotional, long-standing conflicts overseas and the political and economic structures of countries in the regions we're most concerned with. Secondly, we must remember the importance of what foreign governments do in counterterrorism. Of course, we need to pay proper attention to our unilateral assets, be they intelligence assets or military assets, and to ensure that they are constructed and shaped in a way that they can go after this kind of threat. But bearing in mind the transnational nature of the adversary and the informational, jurisdictional, and geographic advantages that our foreign partners so often have, much of what we do in counterterrorism is only as good as the ability and willingness of our foreign partners to cooperate. In fact, virtually everything we do in counterterrorism outside of security measures around domestic sites has a foreign dimension in which we need to rely to some degree on foreign cooperation. And the final thing to remember is the importance of sustained public interest support and commitment, which gets back to my opening point about the importance of commitment. We've had in this country a history of waxing and waning of interest in counterterrorism. It goes up sharply after a major terrorist incident. It fades after a period of time in which we've been free of such incidents. One of the hazards of effective counterterrorism is being the victim of its own success, in the sense that if we are successful and lucky enough to go for a couple of years or so without a major terrorist incident, the interest will wane all that much more. Given the enormity of what happened last September, the bump up in interest and support is far greater than what we've seen after any other incident. But how long the effects of that bump can be sustained will be a big factor in determining just how successful we'll be in counterterrorism in the future. General Scowcroft gave us a rather downbeat note saying, beyond the East Coast, things are already fading, and I suspect he's right. But there's nothing inevitable about this, and I would lay on the table as a last bit of advice to our leaders, let's not reserve so much of our rhetoric and commitment and effort to the immediate aftermath of terrorist attacks, but think about it every day and every week with regard to what's said publicly and what's done publicly by Congress and by the executive branch. Thank you very much. I look forward to the subsequent discussion.
Some of us will no doubt stay home on September 11th, fearful that terrorists may celebrate the anniversary with another attack. Reminded of the terrible events of a year ago, most of us will understandably feel some level of anxiety, will breathe a sigh of relief if the day passes without major event. Others, desperately seeking closure, will interpret the absence of an attack, if that is to be, as proof that the danger has passed. And that would be extremely dangerous. Al-Qaeda remains a significant threat to American security. I do agree with Paul Pillar that since the terrorist attacks of last September, the United States has achieved significant successes. Removing the Taliban government in Afghanistan eliminated Al-Qaeda's sanctuary and training camps, thereby breaking an important link in the process that once provided the terrorist enterprise with a continuing flow of recruits. Toppling the Taliban also underscored the risk run by governments that assist terrorists. Having achieved its initial goals in Afghanistan, the United States is now in a more complex phase of the war. Efforts to destroy Al-Qaeda while at the same time combating terrorism as a mode of conflict will require the orchestration of intelligence collection, the pursuit of traditional criminal investigations, the imposition of financial controls and economic sanctions, as well as offers of material reward, the application of conventional military power, the conduct of covert and special operations, military assistance, and psychological warfare, all to disrupt terrorist operations and destroy terrorist groups. As operations move beyond a single theater, these more complex tasks will be dispersed among numerous departments and agencies. At the same time, greater international cooperation will be required. Without a clear strategy, the focus of the campaign could easily be lost. I believe that the destruction of Al-Qaeda must remain the primary aim of the American campaign. The Al-Qaeda enterprise cannot easily be deterred. And you'll hear me use this term enterprise, and I use it deliberately because I see Al-Qaeda not simply as a group, but as a system, as a process, as an ongoing enterprise. And it's not simply a matter of destroying an organization, it's a matter of disrupting that enterprise. drawing upon a deep reservoir of hatred and a desire for revenge, Al-Qaeda will fight on. U.S. efforts have reduced, they have not eliminated, its ability to mount significant terrorist operations. Al-Qaeda's primary strength derives from its belief system, from its deep sense of brotherhood, from its commitment to action that have brought the organization a certain degree of glory among its constituents, and that contribute to its continuing recruiting. And that has provided it with a pool of resources, human resources, that are far greater than any other terrorist group that I can identify in history. And ultimately, that quantity translated into quality. And we have to disrupt that process. I know that many years ago I argued that terrorists operated under self-imposed constraints, that they were unlikely to resort to weapons of mass destruction. But we cannot rely on self-imposed limits to Al-Qaeda's violence. Attempts to cause massive death and destruction using conventional or unconventional weapons are likely. Although some measure of success has been achieved in thwarting terrorist plots around the world, the ability of U.S. agencies to detect and prevent future terrorist threats and attacks is limited. To be sure, Al-Qaeda must now operate in a less permissive environment. It has lost an easily accessible safe haven, although that loss may not be immediately felt, as it will be able to draw upon its reserves for some time while it tries to establish new centers. And we hear about these being established, whether in Pakistan, Iran, or northern Iraq. But these are likely to be smaller and less accessible. Moreover, the experience in the training camps and participation in Afghanistan's armed conflict served an important role in attracting and indoctrinating thousands of recruits. And again, it's not simply the instruction, it was the inspiration, the indoctrination, this continuing flow of volunteers that I think gave Al-Qaeda its strength. Televised videotapes, virtual realms on the internet may not suffice as a substitute for this physical experience. They may not maintain that high level of devotion. If we can keep Al-Qaeda on the run, the numbers it can train will decline, and declining numbers eventually will result in a corresponding qualitative decline in terrorist operations. Now, we're dealing with a fast-moving situation, and strategy must evolve with developments. But I think that there are 10 basic elements of strategy that are likely to provide us with good guidance, at least for the foreseeable future. Let me run through them very quickly. Number one, the pursuit of Al-Qaeda must be single-minded and unrelenting. I sound like the Senator Cato Al-Qaeda on this particular issue. Single-minded and unrelenting. The episodic nature of terrorism, the burden of security, public impatience for closure should not lure us into a dangerous complacency. We're not going to be able to inflict upon this very amorphous terrorist foe the immediate destruction that would serve as a deterrent to other terrorist entities. However, assured destruction, and I deliberately am using a Cold War term here, assured destruction can be pursued over time, years if necessary, without let up, as an ongoing reminder to others of the consequences of attacking the United States. Number two, the fight in Afghanistan must be continued as long as Al-Qaeda operatives remain there. Premature withdrawal, historically the American tendency, would be dangerous. Only when Al-Qaeda is completely destroyed or when the new Afghan government can effectively exercise authority throughout its territory can withdrawal be risked? Now, long-term operations may require us to reorganize our military forces in Afghanistan. We may have to think of highly specialized forces that are going to be there on long-term assignments. It's also going to require us to carefully control the application of violence in order to reduce the collateral damage that fuels Afghan hostility. Positive benefits of allied involvement, the reconstruction of infrastructure, assistance for healthcare and education, the restoration and preservation of Afghanistan's cultural heritage, can also help to temper the country's natural resistance to outsiders. Number three, Pakistan must be kept on the side of the Allies in efforts to destroy the remnants of al-Qaeda and dilute Islamic extremism. The loss of Pakistan's support could reverse America's victory in Afghanistan. Now, the United States is demanding much of a weak government. We are asking that it help us round up the remaining al-Qaeda members. We're asking it to deal with Islamic extremism within its own borders. We're asking it to rein in those who are dedicated to prizing Kashmir from India. We are nudging it toward democracy. Hopefully we are. We need to provide the political and economic support that will enable that government to demonstrate the positive benefits of alliance while at the same time checking these popular bellicose sentiments. Number four, the crucial second phase of the war on terrorism cannot be accomplished unilaterally. I agree with General Scowcroft. This is not multilateralism for the sake of political correctness. International cooperation is a prerequisite to success. The continued identification and pursuit of al-Qaeda's remaining cells and a successful prosecution of those arrested will require an unprecedented level of multinational coordination. The United States must understand the legal and political concerns of each of its allies and adapt its strategy accordingly. Not every suspected terrorist need be in U.S. custody, nor can information flow only in the direction of Washington. And we have a problem with this. Number five, new networks must be created to exploit intelligence across frontiers. Full cooperation is going to be limited to a few governments. Our traditional allies are cooperating. The British will continue to be among our closest allies. France has global intelligence resources, vast area knowledge, and valuable historical experience. Although Russian leadership tends to see terrorism exclusively through the lens of its conflict in Chechnya, Russia nonetheless has valuable knowledge and experience in Central and South Asia and can be a major contributor to ongoing international efforts to combat terrorism. Diplomacy can also create new relationships that exploit opportunities for cooperation even among governments the United States has previously penalized for their support of terrorism. Number six, we should make a distinction between the war on al-Qaeda and combating terrorism. I use different verbs here deliberately. The president has said we are at war, a status officially endorsed by Congress. This more formal expression of belligerency against terrorists and those who assist them enables the government to more easily keep the initiative. The use of the term war does not end American efforts to bring terrorists to justice through the legal system, either the American system or that of other countries with capable authorities who are willing to enforce the law. The United States is not going to pursue every terrorist in the world, but as a matter of self-defense, it will wage war against terrorists capable of causing casualties on the scale of September 11th. The target is specific, the task is finite. But America is not at war with terrorism. Terrorism is a phenomenon, not a foe. We have been combating terrorism for 30 years. Some successes have been achieved, although it's an enduring task, and it will continue to be an enduring task. To make terrorism an unattractive mode of conflict, the United States will seek to expand international conventions and cooperation. It will assist in resolving conflicts that may produce terrorism, and will try to address some of the causes of the deep hatred that terrorists are able to exploit. America is not at war with everyone's terrorists, and not all nations need the frontline participants in the war against Al-Qaeda. But all nations must cooperate in combating terrorism, an obligation that since September 11th has been formally recognized in the United Nations. Number 7, political warfare should not be neglected. It is not sufficient to merely outgun the terrorists. The enemy here is more than a group. It's an ideology, a set of attitudes, a belief system organized into a recruiting network that will replace terrorist losses unless ultimately defeated politically. At a strategic level, political warfare should be aimed at reducing the appeal of the extremists, encouraging alternate views that are currently silenced by fear and hostile policy, and discouraging terrorist use of weapons of mass destruction. Number 8, the very nature of the terrorist enterprise makes the traditional strategy of deterrence difficult to apply. But wait, the notion of deterrence should not be too hastily abandoned. Deterrence can be employed in targeting terrorist support systems. Economic sanctions, although blunt and sometimes cruel instruments, have had some effect in modifying state behavior. The fate of the Taliban serves as further warning. Financial contributors to terrorist fronts may be deterred by threats of negative publicity, blocked investments, asset seizures, or increased scrutiny of their financial activities. Influence is a viable component of our strategy. Number 9, as terrorists escalate their violence, it is necessary to create a firebreak that signals a different set of responses if terrorists attempt to use weapons of mass destruction. And I include here weapons of mass effect, that is, chemical or biological weapons that, even if they don't kill in the hundreds or thousands, are capable of producing widespread psychological effects. I have long believed that it should be a well-understood article of American policy that prevent terrorist acquisition and use of weapons of mass destruction. The United States will take whatever measures it deems appropriate, including unilateral preemptive military action. The United States may reassure its allies that preemptive action is unlikely. In circumstances where local authorities have the ability of taking action themselves, and can be depended upon to do so. If preemptive action is required, then the government should be prepared to make a compelling public case that such action is justified. Finally, number 10, the war against terrorists must be conducted in a way that is consistent with American values. I feel very strongly about this. America cannot expect the world's applause for every action it takes in pursuit of terrorists abroad, but it's important not to lose the moral high ground of international support upon which the United States unavoidably will depend if it is to win the war. Some collateral damage may be unavoidable in any war, but our violence must never be wanton. The United States can be ruthless. It must never appear careless. Increased security at home does not require us to surrender our freedoms. There's no currency exchange here. Without security, there is no freedom, and people without freedom have no security. Every liberal democracy confronting terrorism has been obliged to modify rules governing intelligence collection, police powers, detention, access to lawyers, or trial procedures. Captured terrorists may be tried in civilian courts or before military tribunals, but in either case, rules of evidence and the right to representation should apply. It is appropriate that every modification of the rules be clearly set forth, widely discussed, and endorsed by legislation with renewal requirements to ensure that it does not become a permanent feature of the landscape. We can protect our society. We must protect our values. Thank you.
I want to start by taking mild issue with my very dear friend Brent Scowcroft and try to outline why I think September 11th, in fact, was something new and why it was different. And what I would argue is there were four elements of the attack of September 11th which were new to the war against terrorism and indeed new to American security and which therefore have an implication far beyond, in my view, far beyond the simple question of the war on terrorism. The first of those elements has been referred to in passing in particular by Brian, which is the shift in the motives of terrorist groups. The terrorist groups which we studied in the 60s and 70s and which we fought here and in Europe basically acted, as he pointed out, as Brian pointed out, under self-imposed restraints. They didn't want to kill so many people that they turned off the public. They wanted just enough to get the television cameras there. We saw a shift starting in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, towards terrorists who instead were motivated by hatred, revenge, or in the case of al-Qaeda, religious extremism. And terrorists with those kinds of motivations were no longer under any self-imposed restraints. And indeed, we saw in the figures kept by the United States government the paradox that while the number of terrorist incidents went down in the 1990s, the number of casualties from terrorism actually went up. And in this respect, I want to say something to our European colleagues, because many of the Europeans today, as they look at our war on terrorism, tend to say, well, we had all that. We fought that terrorism back in the 70s and 80s. We know all about that. And I say to my European friends, what we experienced on 9/11 had virtually nothing to do and nothing in similarity with what you experienced in the 80s and 90s, sorry, in the 70s and 80s. It is a different phenomenon, and that is important. Very important. The second new element, which relates therefore to the first, is that the terrorists, for the first time really in a major way in the 90s, in 1993 in the attack on the World Trade Center, and then of course again last year, were prepared to attack on American soil. During the 20 years from when modern terrorism burst on the scene in 1968 to roughly 1988, we had very little terrorism in the United States, very little international terrorism. But now we saw a shift, a major shift. And indeed, not only were they willing to attack us in the United States, but they were able to attack us in the United States. And indeed, they are among us. For the first time, we suddenly realized that terrorists were living among us, going to the Friday night high school football games, sending their kids to our schools, shopping at our malls on Saturday afternoon, and flying planes at 500 miles an hour into our buildings. And that is something very new. The third new element relates to a point that Brent made earlier, and that is related to globalization. The fact is that during the 1990s, the terrorists now have access to information about weapons of mass destruction that was in the 70s and 80s the purvey only of scientists and experts and people working in classified areas. The internet now has ways on it. You can search it and find how to grow anthrax in your basement, how to make a nuclear weapon. These things were not the case. And we know not only is that access there, but we know particularly in the case of al-Qaeda that terrorist groups are seeking those weapons of mass destruction. We know that al-Qaeda tried to buy uranium early in the decade. We know from the findings in the camps that were overrun in Afghanistan that they had experiments in chemical and biological weapons. So not only do we have a shift in motives and the fact that terrorists are living among us, but we know that those terrorists now are trying to or may have gotten their hands on weapons of mass destruction, which would allow them to inflict massive casualties consistent with their motives of hatred and extremism. And this is, as Brian pointed out, in many ways the opposite of the analysis that those of us who were in government in the 70s and 80s made, which was that terrorists could have escalated to weapons of mass destruction, but were, by their own restraints, held back from doing that. And this then comes to the fourth element. This comes to the fourth element, which is where I think the administration is correct, unlike what Brent says, and that is the connection to the new geopolitical reality. The fact is, as Brent pointed out, that at the end of the Cold War, the United States was left in the most dominant position of any country in history. There is no historical parallel. And the lesson of the Gulf War was, if you hated the United States, you could not attack us with conventional weapons. Saddam had the fourth largest army in the world at the time, and we swept him aside in a matter of days. So there are new elements here. There are new elements here, and we know that of the seven states which the State Department identifies as states supporting terrorism, five have active programs in weapons of mass destruction and have some form of ballistic missile programs going on. Iraq, most prominent among these, but Iran and North Korea also being cases. And whether one likes the term the president used, an axis of evil, there certainly is a nexus of evil between terrorist groups which are willing, indeed want to kill us in our thousands, terrorist groups which would like to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, and states which have those weapons. What are the implications of these four new elements? First of all, we face, as Brian said, a serious and relentless enemy. The enemy is organized in some cases into groups, terrorist groups, enterprises if you wish, and in some cases is organized in traditional nation states. And we have to be as relentless as they are. Secondly, this threat is not going to dissipate on its own, and nor will it dissipate through wishful thinking. We are going to have to act. We're going to have to act quickly. In a word, we're going to have to kill them before they kill us. We have arrested some 2,400 to 2,500 terrorists. This is a commendable record. But if you consider that something between 30 and 40,000, we don't know the number, but something like 30 or 40,000 people went through the training camps in Afghanistan, you can see how much work is left to be done. Now, the real question for me is, has anything really changed? Have we really learned the lessons? And I would point to three areas. First of all, have we learned the lesson of what this new threat means in terms of intelligence? And I would argue that we had a catastrophic failure of intelligence on September 11th. There's no way to argue with it when you have 3,000 Americans killed. Something has gone very wrong. One of the elements that has not been examined closely enough yet in this country is the fact that since the terrorists are living among us, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of intelligence collection capabilities do we need within the United States? We have, for 200 years, resisted having a domestic intelligence agency for a lot of very good reasons. But we are now the only major industrial country in the world that does not have one. Brent referred to the FBI as being an intelligence agency, but it's not, of course. It's an enforcement agency. It's a law enforcement agency. And he pointed out the cultures of intelligence and law enforcement are very different. And it seems to me this is a question that has still not yet been adequately addressed in this town. Secondly, we see a tendency towards business as usual in this town now as we look at the question of defending ourselves at home. Homeland security has suddenly become again a partisan football, with a lot of people arguing that we can do this without rushing. We can do it without really changing the organizations just by slapping them together into a new Department of Homeland Security. This will not work. It can't be business as usual when the threat we face is as different as it is. And finally, there is the question of preemption. I believe very strongly that the arguments are very conclusive that we must be prepared to preempt. I do not accept the argument that we should wait. I am reminded in his introduction to his magnificent history of the Second World War, Churchill wrote that in these books you will read how the logical and moderate path led straight to the bullseye of disaster. There is a time in international relations for taking bold steps, even though all of the evidence may not be there. And there I slightly disagree with Paul. I think the arguments for hitting Afghanistan were strong in the 1990s and could have been exercised. It would have been, as you point out, Paul, difficult to justify, but gosh, we would have saved ourselves an awful lot of trouble if we'd done it. And it is this argument, indeed, that brings together the question of Iraq. We know that Iraq has supported terrorists in the past. We know that Iraq continues to support terrorists. Abu Nidal died there just 2 weeks ago. They're giving bounties to the families of Palestinian terrorist bombers in the West Bank. We know that Iraq has had programs of weapons of mass destruction and no inspections for 4 years. It seems to me the argument for preemption against Iraq, preemptive defense, if you will, is conclusive. And my own prediction is that three things will happen when the president makes up his mind. First of all, he'll get the support of his cabinet. Secondly, when he goes to Congress, he will get an overwhelming support for the action he decides to take in Congress, much more than his father got. And thirdly, I predict that almost all our allies at that time will support us. It is important to have our allies, I agree. Again, to quote Churchill, the only thing worse than fighting with your allies is fighting without them. So it would be helpful to have them there. But in the end, the United States president has to do what he has to do. And given the destructive power that is in the hands of terrorist groups now and states, it seems to me immoral to argue that a president should wait until he's attacked and then respond. He has to move to a policy away from wait and respond to a policy of detect and destroy. Thank you.